This is Franz. Welcome back to the Sailing in the Mediterranean podcast. I went into iTunes and I was looking at some of the comments on the podcast, and there was one comment by, and I question this name, by 10-year-old boy on June 5th this year, 2014. He said, "I'm just learning about sailing and plan to do a bareboat charter someday, and I wanted to learn more about sailing in general via audio. Although a lot of it is over my head, it's helpful to hear the terminology and hear about things that have come up during Franz's travels in the Mediterranean. Two of the episodes that I've heard so far are interviews with charter managers. Love the one in the BVI and the one in Greece. It would be good to hear more basic information about sailing in general, safety, guidelines, do's and don'ts, and any kind of training for newcomers to the sport. Anything that would help listeners prepare for the ASA classes would be great. Additional information to include. There doesn't seem to be any other podcasts in the whole topic, so Franz has a monopoly. Thanks again for helping me learn how to sail while I drive." It got me thinking. I've been working on a podcast. It's called the Series 7 podcast, which is for people studying for the Series 7 examination. And I've monetized that podcast. I put out the podcast, and then I've also made it available in iTunes and Amazon for a more convenient way to download the podcast quickly to prepare for the tests. And 10-year-old boy, if you're driving, you're not 10 years old, by the way, so that's why I question your screen name. But I think we're all young kids. At least men never grow up. Women become more mature, more elegant. I don't know about you, but I won't say my age, but I'm still a teenager at heart. Well, I was thinking, and I went onto the ASA website, and I looked at their courses, and I'd never really given much thought to the organized courses, because I never learned through an organized course. I learned by racing, and I had a mentor, and I learned by sailing. I didn't learn by going to courses, and I don't really have an appreciation for that, just because that's not the way I learned. But it made me think that just because I did it one way doesn't mean other people can't learn to sail in different ways. And for a lot of people, perhaps going and taking classes is the best alternative they have. They may not have the ability or the time to devote to it that I had when I joined a racing crew. Because when you join a racing crew, it's a big time commitment. It's all day, usually both days on weekends. And you learn to sail very quickly. You make a lot of mistakes at somebody else's expense, and I always point that out. That's the advantage of learning to sail by racing. But for those who want to go and take courses, maybe there's a market for what I could provide. I'm not an ASA instructor. I never will be. I don't plan on going through the bureaucracy to become an ASA instructor. But I'm sure I have every bit of knowledge that they have and probably a lot more. I think I will put together a course that goes through the steps and stages of the information you're going to need, at least for the material that you would be tested on without actually sailing. Now, the sailing part of any test with the ASA would have to be done with the instructors and at a facility that can certify you. But I'm going to start out with the basic keelboat course, which is a lot of terminology, and I've already done the introduction to the series and the first lesson. And I will put together an audio course, and it's not going to be free, but it's not going to be very expensive either, that will allow you to listen to it while you're traveling, if you want to, if it's something that's of interest to you. Now, I don't think there's a big market for this, but it's something I can provide, and it's something that I'd enjoy doing. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to put together an audio course for ASA 101, which is the basic keel boat course, and then there's two others that I will put together as well. As I finish one, I'll start working on the other, which would get you to your basic certification that allows you to charter. When I've chartered boats, I've never had to show any sort of certification, but then again, I've always had a commercial Coast Guard license, which is a lot more certification than you will get from ASA. My nephew, who sailed with me this summer, was talking to me about taking some ASA courses up in the San Juan Islands, and I said, well, any chance you get to go up to the San Juan Islands and sail, that's a great experience. I love sailing up in the San Juan Islands and up in Washington, the state of Washington. So even though I don't have any opinion on the course, it certainly can't hurt, and it's a great excuse to go sailing. So I'm going to start working on that. If you have comments of specific topics you would like covered, send me an email. Use the contact form of the website. That's medsailor.com. And I'll try to incorporate your comments. My intention on teaching the course is going to be reinforcing the lessons that I prepare with stories, because I think people learn well with stories. It's not going to be dry that this is a gooseneck and it attaches to the boom and the clue on the mainsail is attached to the outhaul. No, I'll probably say, well, the outhaul is what attaches to the clue on the mainsail. 2 years ago, when I was sailing, that welded piece broke, and I lost control of my mainsail at that point in time because I don't have a rope tied to it. So how did I deal with that problem? Well, in that situation, I basically took a line to the clue on the mainsail and then jury-rigged a outhaul with that line. And of course, that served me all summer long. That was summer before 2014. So that was the summer of 2013. That served me all summer long. And this year, as I was putting the boat in the water, I had the boatyard fix the outhaul for me. So I solved the problem later on. But I got through the whole summer with the jury rig repair. So I'll tell stories about what has happened to me regarding different terminology and try to make it somewhat entertaining. And it's not going to be very expensive. Well, with that little bit of introduction out of the way, let's talk about what's been going on in Utah. September 1st rolled around, the grouse season came in. During the summer, I'd been hiking in the area. I plan on doing some elk and deer hunting near our summer home in the Uinta Mountains. And every day I would go out, I didn't see any elk. And I saw quite a few deer, but I didn't see very many bucks. But I got familiar with the territory, very, very familiar with the territory that I plan on hunting in. And every day that I would go out, I would always kick up five or six what used to be called blue grouse, but are now termed Duffy grouse. So September 1st rolls around, which is the opening of the grouse season. I go out and I don't see a single grouse. Yesterday I was up at the summer home and my son-in-law had been up there and he'd seen about 20 grouse and he'd shot seven. And I said, don't take them all. He said, oh, there's plenty of them up there. They're all over the place. And I went up yesterday and I got one grouse. One grouse is about the size of the grouse I got yesterday was about the size of a medium-sized chicken, probably a smaller chicken. So it'll be a nice meal. But I hiked probably 10 miles yesterday, up 2,000 vertical feet and down. And I had my friend George, who's a very, very accomplished hunter. He worked for the Alaska Fish and Game for a while, and he's a consultant for various state fish and games, and he came up and went with me. I always learn a lot from George, and he said, well, you've got to be looking for the food that they eat, the food they eat. And we couldn't find any of the food that they eat until we came down lower, and we did see some food, but we didn't see any grouse. So the only grouse I got was in the morning before he got up there, and we didn't see any other grouse the rest of the day. However, we did see a couple bucks, and we scared up, well, George saw two bull elk and some cows that were bedded down with the bull elk. I saw two cow elks, or a cow and a calf elk, coming down the mountain. Good hike. I am sore today, so I'm going to sit in front of the microphone and put out a podcast. So today I'm going to continue talking about the cruising areas And the last episode, we talked about the Ionian Islands, which is the westernmost part of Greece. Today, I'm just assuming that you're traveling from Europe and you're moving towards Turkey. So I'm going to work our way from west to east. And I'm going to cover the Gulf of Corinth. And as if you were sailing from the Ionian Islands, I'll tell about how I've sailed from the Ionian Islands and the harbors, the bays, the anchorages that I've stopped at along the way. Every time I have left the Ionian Islands, I've always left from the island of Ithaca and either Vathi or Chione or other anchorages farther on down the island of Ithaca, always on the east side of the island. And the last time I was at an anchorage with the current running through it, I got up early in the morning. I was by myself. And again, I was on the west side of Greece. So in the morning, there's not much wind. So it's a long haul. I'm not sure exactly the distance. Let me open up Google Earth and we can give you some distances. I also am referencing a book, which is pretty much the Bible for sailors, which is a book by Rod Heichel called Greek Waters Pilot, A Yachtsman's Guide to the Ionian and Aegean Coasts of Greece. This is one that I've got here at home. It's the 9th edition. I think I have a more recent edition on the boat. These are essential. I don't care what it costs you. You have to have this book if you're going to be sailing in Greece. And you have to have the other various pilot books as you're sailing through the Mediterranean. I don't think that this podcast acts as a pilot. I rely on as much information as I can get. And in his book, he also talks about the various areas, and he breaks it up pretty much like I am doing it, from west to east. And he goes into much more detail about the weather patterns. I'm not going to quote from his book because I'm just going to really be talking about my own personal experiences here. All right, Google Earth is open. Let's go. Try to take me to Ithaca, New York. No, I mean Ithaca, Greece. All right, and actually I can see I have some tracks that I put in here. In Google Earth, where I had anchored was just on the inside of the island of Lygia, which is just off the east coast of Ithaca. Lygia is an uninhabited island, just a little tiny islet, I guess I would say. So let me get a distance of from there to... And I actually, that day, I went a long ways. I went from there to Trezona in one day, which was a long, long day. I was by myself, and when I'm by myself, I will often travel farther than I would with a crew on board. Okay, so from Ithaca to Messagoline, which would be the closest port in the Gulf of Patra, it's about 35 nautical miles, maybe 36 nautical miles. That's going to be the first safe port that you could really pull into. And then the next port would be Patra, and Patra would be about 47 miles. I've gone to both places, and I'm going to talk about the first stop, Messagoline. Well, actually, it's in I'm looking at Rod Heichel's book. It's spelled Messalonghi, Messalonghi. First time I stopped into Messalonghi, you've got to be careful on your approach. It's very shallow off the southern coast of the mainland Greece at that point, and so you have to follow some very specific navigation aids to get into the canal that goes up to the town of Messagoline. From the mouth of the canal up to the bay is about 3.6 nautical miles. So it's a long, long canal that they keep dredged out that you go up to get into Messagoline. Now, Messagoline is where Lord Byron died. I'm not a particular Byron fan, but it's a bit of a strange port. When I pulled in there the first time, it's a big, big protected bay, and and somebody was building a full-service marina there. The full-service marina was nowhere near completion, so we tied up and wandered into town. And it's a long ways away from town. The actual marina has very little of interest around the marina. It's not like most Greek marinas or most Greek harbors where the town is around the harbor and there's a lot of nightlife there. This, you were sort of out in Never Never Land, and it was a bizarre place. We took a long walk into town. The town was not very appealing. It felt a little strange. I came back a few years later. The town was still as strange as it was before, but the marina was fully developed at that point in time. However, they were offering a special because they were trying to build up business. It would be a good place to winter your boat if you're a European boat. Of course, if you're an American boat or a non-European boat, don't ever even consider leaving your boat in Greece because you will be taxed like crazy by the Greek government. And I talked to another sailor this summer that was just dealing with this bureaucracy, this just big, huge bureaucracy issue. He didn't realize it, and they were trying to tax him to the tune of several thousand dollars. So if you're a non-European boat or non-EU boat, please don't make the same mistake I did. Leave your boat in Turkey or somewhere else, but don't consider leaving it in Greece. But if you are a European, you might consider this marina. The trouble is, it's one hell of a long ways from anywhere. It would be difficult to make connections to get to this marina. I don't know how you would do it. By air, you would fly into Previsa or Patra and then somehow make your connections overland up to this town. There was a field just near the marina that had a bunch of old fighter jets in it. And it was just out there in the middle of nowhere. It had a fence around it, but the fence had been broken down, and you could walk in, and it almost felt like an air museum. And it probably was intended to be an air museum, but it was not being taken care of, and it was not secure at all. But my friend Roger took a lot of photographs. He's a buff of old airplanes. And he took a lot of photographs of the planes that were sitting on the ground near the marina. That was about the only thing of interest I found in Missolonghi. The next port that you could come to that would be a safe overnight port would be Patra. Patra's a big city. I've spent several days, several times at the marina in Patra. It's a full-service marina with full prices. And it's a nice walk into town. You are really in the town, even at Patra, but you're more in the resort area, a lot of hotels around where you're at. It's fairly nice. They have water, electricity. When I was there one time, it was still fairly bumpy. They hadn't built a very good breakwater, and the wind was from the west blowing into the marina, and it was fairly bumpy, but it was still safe. The town itself is pretty interesting, and they have a market once a week that's sort of hard to find. You have to ask around. You have to, first of all, find the day that they have the vegetable market, the outdoor vegetable market, and then it's sort of hard to find it once you know the day. But it's always fun to wander through these markets when they're open. I know one year I bought a pot of basil that I put on the boat, and I'd use it for garnishes all summer long. And at the end of the year, that's when I was sailing up to Croatia. At the end of the year, I took the pot down and put it down, and it disappeared the next day. Somebody else had picked it up, so passed it along. Going east from Patra or Missolonghi, there used to be a harbor that you could stop in called Navpactos, and it's a very, very narrow entrance. And the first time I went in there, I was coming from, again, this is when I was working my way up to Croatia. And it talked about the difficulty of getting into this harbor. But we were able to get into it, and I was looking around, trying to find a place to tie up the boat. And as I was looking around, another boat came in, knew where it was going, and took the one remaining spot in the harbor. Very, very small harbor. You could probably only put about 5 boats in this harbor. The next time I was coming through here, I went back up there, and it had silted in, and you could not even go into Navpacos unless you had a very, very shallow draft boat. So a keelboat could not even get in there. But it was a real interesting fortress type of harbor. And I would like to go there, but it's not going to be in my boat. When I went by there the last time, there was a very strong westerly wind blowing. There was a boat that had anchored just outside of Navpacos, and it was getting bucked around. It looked like it was in tremendous danger. It looked like if its anchor broke, it would be on shore in no time at all. There was a man out on the bow. I don't know what he was doing, but he was bouncing up and down, probably trying to decide how he was going to get out of there. But I would have motored forward, pulled up my anchor, and got out of there as quickly as possible. The next place you're going to go to, going from west to east, first of all, you've gone through the Gulf of Patra. You're going to go under the bridge at Patra, and you need to call ahead with bridge control. And I'm not sure exactly what the VHF channel is. I learned about this after I'd just gone through it. I've gone through it twice without ever contacting bridge control, and nobody's come after me. But apparently you're supposed to contact bridge control, and they will tell you which side of the bridge you should clear on. And I just, like I say, I've gone through it twice. I didn't realize I was supposed to call bridge control and just wandered on through. As long as you don't bump into anything, I think you're fine. But if you did have a problem, you would probably be in a lot of trouble for not contacting bridge control. But really, the next safe place to tie up is a good all-around port on the island of Trezona. And I've had some interesting experiences on the island of Trezona. First of all, this marina is a full-service marina that was never finished. This is one of several that I found in Greece where I think the EU put a bunch of money into developing the infrastructure of this marina. They put in the big concrete quays. They put in everything, and they were waiting for the Greeks to finish it up, and the Greeks never finished it up. As a result, there's no services, and it doesn't cost anything. It's a big marina. There's plenty of room. There's people that winter their boats there, and boats that have sunk at anchor there that are still in the water, and nobody takes care of it. There's some derelict boats that are there. It's sort of sad. Well, on my way through, I didn't have a crew joining me for a few days, and so I spent, I think, 4 or 5 days just on the island of Trezona. I was running out of water, and there was a few other boats tied up at the quay running out of the water, and I was as far away from a faucet as I could be. There was one water faucet, and it was probably a good 200 yards, 300 yards away from the boat. Well, every boat there, we sort of got together, and we said, hey, why don't we see if we can get enough hoses to connect to it? And lo and behold, we were all able to get all of our hoses out and run it over to the faucet, and we were all able to fill up our water. I was the one farthest down. Well, what you'll find when you're sailing is you tend to have a lot of water hose, and you tend to have a lot of electrical line, because sometimes the electrical outlets are a long ways away from your boat. So I have a lot of water hose on my boat and a lot of electrical line on my boat. I learned that the hard way. So it's a neat little port. I like it. It's very well protected. You meet interesting people. Charter boats, don't ever go there, because there's no reason to charter in the Gulf of Patra or the Gulf of Corinth. So the boats coming through there are going to be cruisers or people delivering boats. Quite a few years ago, my family and I sailed to the island of Trezona, and we'd tied up at the end of the quay. And my daughters were, I don't know what the age were. They were 10, 12, 9, something like that. And there was another boat, large boat there. And there was a couple of young kids on that boat. And my daughters, of course, went over and started playing with their friends. And we got to know the people, and we ended up getting on the boat and having drinks at night. And it was the boat that had been owned by the yachtsman Peter Blake. This was his personal cruising boat. And Peter Blake was a very famous sailor who was from New Zealand, and he was murdered in the Amazon on another racing boat. And they were bringing his boat through to be sold. They were taking it to the big marina at Mallorca, which is a popular place for boats to be exchanged to buy and sell boats in Mallorca. So they were moving the boat through, and they invited us on the boat and looked around the boat, and it felt a lot larger than our boat did, of course, but our boat is very small. So Trezonia is a very nice stopping spot, probably the best place you're going to stop, except for the next town I'm going to talk about, which is Galaxidi. Now, if you're going to go visit Delphi, the first time I decided to go visit Delphi, again, was with the same trip with my family, and we went into the town of Itea, I-T-E-A, which is the closest port marina that you can get to Delphi. And then we tied up, and the marina was okay, but the town was sort of dusty, and it was not a particularly attractive place to visit. But we went up to Delphi and visited Delphi and came back and headed off. Now, the next time I came through, instead of going to Itea, I went to a town called Galaxidi. And Galaxidi was just a delightful town and one of my favorite spots. In fact, my favorite spot behind Trezonia in the Gulf of Corinth for stopping into. In fact, it's one of the places I will go and spend several days just because I like the town. It's a beautiful, classic Greek town. It has a shipping heritage. There's some Greek shipping families that hail from Galaxidi. There's a guy that will meet you when you come into your boat. When you back into the quay there, there's going to be a guy by the name of Antonio that's going to greet you and tell you about everything in the town, get your email address, and send you a Christmas email. And he's been doing that for years. He may try to sell you something. If there's something you want and he can offer it to you, he'll be glad to make a little money. But as a general rule, he's just doing this as an ambassador of goodwill. And I've seen him every time I've gone in there, and it's sort of like a good friend that you see again. So he's a nice guy. Antonio, when you see him, say Fran said hello. All right. There is not much between Galaxidi and the Corinth Canal. There's a couple anchorages that I've stopped at, but there's really nothing in particular. They're safe anchorages on the north coast of mainland Greece, and I don't need to go into those. You can just find them on your own. You can look at a chart and find some fairly safe anchorages. The winds are going to be prevailing from the north or the east or the west. But if you find a little cove tucked into, as we have on the north coast between Galaxidi and the Corinth Canal, they're there. Now, one year we were coming from east to west and we'd gone through the Corinth Canal, and we stopped at the town of Corinth, and it was, it was not particular. The actual town of Corinth is more of an industrial town. They have an industrial port there, and they have a small marina there, and not much of any interest. I wouldn't make an effort to go back there again. But another time when we were coming through, we were going from east to west. We had come through the Corinth Canal, and we didn't want to go to the town of Corinth. We decided we wanted to go around the corner and see some of the other harbors to the north of the Corinth Canal. And so we were heading up to the only real marina there. We went to Porto Germino, and it was fairly early in the day, and it was very light winds. We were running downwind with just the drifter out, very, very light winds. We weren't in a hurry because we thought we'd be able to stop here for the night, and it wasn't that far away. So I threw a line overboard, put on my mask and fins and snorkel, and jumped in and let the boat tow me through the water. And I was towed through the water for a few miles, and I was absolutely amazed that I saw almost no marine life. None. I saw maybe one or two jellyfish float by me while I was doing this, but that's about all. We got to Porto Germino, and it was full of little local fishing boats. There was no room there, so don't make an effort. Don't make the mistake we did and head there. So once we got there, it was later in the day, we had to start up the engine and go and try to find another place to anchor. And that's when we basically found a little cove on the north coast and anchored for the night. And the next day, we went over to Galaxidi. Again, that was when we were heading from... That was the year I was heading up to Croatia. The last thing I'm going to cover in this podcast is going through the Corinth Canal. When you approach the Corinth Canal from west to east, you basically just sit there and wait and wait and wait and wait until you get a signal to go through. And the signal is going to come by VHF radio. And I'm actually going to go to Rod Heichel's book, where he goes through the procedure for going through the Corinth Canal. There can be a current going through the Corinth Canal, so it can affect how fast you go through there. Now, on each side of the Corinth Canal, there's a hydraulic bridge. And I didn't quite understand what was meant by a hydraulic bridge. But the hydraulic bridge is actually a bridge that goes up and down, straight up and straight down, like an elevator. So it's very bizarre to see this solid bridge there, and then it just disappears into the water. So it's raised and lowered. It doesn't swing, doesn't lift. It's raised and lowered in the water. All right, the VHF channel that you will call the canal on is VHF channel 11. So you'll call VHF channel 11. They will tell you to wait, and then they will come online and say, get through right away. And then you have to hustle on through the canal. It's pretty spectacular. The trip through the canal is pretty spectacular. And I've done it, I think, 4 times now. And I'm always taking pictures because it's a straight up wall on both sides that go way up to some bridges up above. And there's always a lot of people on the top looking down at the boats going through the canal. When you go from west to east, you don't stop anywhere. Once you get through the canal, you have to stop on the east side of the canal, tie up to the side, get out, and go into the offices and pay your dues. And I'm looking in Rod Heichel's book, and the prices have changed quite a bit. But I think it's around 100 euros for my boat for going through the canal. And my boat is 28 feet on deck, 37 overall. I never show them the overall length because it's a bowsprit. And the documentation shows 28 feet on deck. So that's how you go through the canal. It's interesting. Some days they shut down the canal. Every now and then, there was one time I was sitting in a marina in Ithaca, and I was talking to another boat, and he was a power boat. And I said, where are you headed? And he was headed east. And he said, I'm waiting for the strike to end. I said, what do you mean? He said, oh yeah, the Corinth Canal is closed. They're on a strike. And he's been there for several days waiting for the strike to end. So don't assume that you're going to be able to go through the canal. You better make sure you understand the political situation and make sure they're not striking. It hadn't been something I had even considered. I'd always assumed that it would be open, but that's not necessarily the case. Hey, that's the end of this podcast. I really appreciate the comments and the reviews that you give me in iTunes, and I do appreciate the notes that I get from the listeners. Thanks a lot. If you have some suggestions on what you'd like me to cover in the future podcast, let me know. But I'm going to continue working my way through the cruising areas and relating stories along the way. If you own a charter company or if you have services for the marine industry in the Mediterranean and you'd like to be interviewed, contact me. There were 2 people that contacted me this summer while I was sailing, and I said, contact me when I get back, and I've never heard from you. So if you'd like to be interviewed, tell us what your company does. Tell us about your charter bases. Give me a call. No, don't give me a call. Drop me an email. Use a contact form at the website. Or just send the email to Franz, F-R-A-N-Z, at medsailor.com. The only problem with that is I get so many emails that unless I know who you are, it goes to junk mail. But I do try to look at my junk mail every day to see if there's somebody I should respond to. But if you do use the contact form at the website, I always look at those emails. All right. Thanks a lot. Happy sailing.